The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Many people are concerned about economics these days. And I read somewhere a headline, I didn't read the article, but the headline said something like, many people are turning to religion. I don't know what, you know, where our faith is better placed, in the U.S. Treasury or in religion. And so it's a little bit on my mind today, since you know, we're kind of a religion here, and maybe people come here sometimes like, well, hell. So I want to start with this story from this very special monastery. At the beginning of every year, the abbot would meet with the new monks who had joined the monastery over the preceding year. At the meeting, he would instruct them to pack their bags. He was going to take them on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of Buddhism. Knowing of pilgrimages that Buddhists will take to places in India where the Buddha was born, enlightened, first thought, taught, and died, the new monks couldn't believe their good fortune. And after their first months in the monastery, some of the new monks were bored. Some were unsure why they were there, and others were restless. On the day of the departure, all the older monks in the monastery stood by the gate to send off the abbot and the new monks. Leading the group, the abbot first took them to a hospital. There the monks spent many hours visiting the sick. Then the abbot took the group to an old age home. The new monks, many who were quite young, were amazed at the ravishes of old age of some of the residents of the home. The abbot then took the monks to see a hospice. In the hours there, the monks spent time with people in all ages of dying, including a long silent vigil with someone recently dead. The abbot then led the group back to the monastery. There they first visited a monk, sick in the monastery infirmary. The new monks were struck by the sparkle of joy which radiated through the tired eyes of the patient. Then they went to visit the oldest resident of the monastery, a 96-year-old monk. The new monks were amazed to see the love and acceptance the toothless, frail, and stooped monk had. Next, the abbot took them to the hospice wing of the monastery. Here they were introduced to a monk who, only days away from his death, radiated a palpable peace that lingered within them for hours after. Finally, the abbot took the monks to the meditation hall. When they were all seated, he said, "You have seen the holy sites. These are the sites that motivated the Buddha to awaken. Once you are awakened, sickness, old age, and death will not trouble you anymore." So the holy sites of Buddhism. And so the collapse of the United States economy can be seen as a holy site. Holy moly. Not that it's a good thing, but that it somehow can be very motivating. And motivating not only to kind of maybe change direction in our lives or question what's really important, but then also be motivated to some kind of healthy response. So in the time of the Buddha, there were many people who responded to the Buddha, certainly, but also to their encounter with sickness, old age, and death. And there's a wonderful collection of poems or songs from the women, the nuns, who were disciples of the Buddha in his first generation. And they wrote these beautiful poems about their practice and their enlightenment, their awakening. I want to read a few of them. Here's one from a nun named Dantika. As I left my daytime resting place on Vulture Peak, I saw an elephant come up on the riverbank after its bath. A man took a hook and said to the elephant, "Give me your foot." The elephant stretched out its foot. The man mounted. Seeing what was wild before gone tame under human hands, I went into the forest and concentrated my mind. So she was inspired. The elephant tamer had tamed the elephant, and now he was under the command of the elephant tamer. And if you could tame an elephant, probably you can tame your own mind. Is your mind wilder than an elephant? Yeah? Uh-oh. So she was inspired, and so that inspiration, she went back into the forest and concentrated her mind. So some of them concentrated their minds and practiced. 4 or 5 times, probably over a long period of time, 4 or 5 times I left my cell, my monastic cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught me the Dharma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, and earth, water, fire, and wind. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged 7 days full of joy. When on the 8th I stretched my feet out, the great dark was torn apart. So her awakening was described as a great dark torn apart. A nun named Upachala. I was a nun, mindful, clear-sighted, and self-composed. There is a peace that evil does not know, and I entered peace like an arrow. And Susipachala said, a nun who has self-possession and integrity will find the peace that nourishes and never causes surfeit. The peace that nourishes. And this one takes the form of a conversation between Chala, nun, and Mara. Mara is the Buddhist personification of the tempter. His job is to keep people from getting enlightened. She says, I, a nun, trained and self-composed, established mindfulness, and entered peace like an arrow. The elements of body and mind grew still. Happiness came. Then Mara said, who told you to shave your head? You look like a renunciant to me. Why do you practice this nonsense? Chala said, everyone outside the path depend on views, opinions, beliefs. They don't know the Dharma. They have no real understanding. But in the Sakya clan, the students of Shakyamuni, the Buddha, but in the Sakya clan, in the Sakya clan, which is the clan the Buddha came from, in the Sakya clan, the unrivaled Buddha was born. He taught me the way, the complete overcoming of views, as follows. There is suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the great eightfold path that stills all suffering. When I heard his words, I rejoiced. So she also entered peace like an arrow. And when he challenges her that it's all nonsense, this practice, she responds by saying, making a distinction between those who follow views, beliefs, and those who don't. And the Buddha doesn't offer a view, doesn't offer a belief or an opinion or even a teaching, you know, in an abstract way or as tenets, but rather he offers a way of seeing our life, a way of participating in our life, where we, what's important how we see is to see the suffering, to see the cause of the suffering, to see the ending of that suffering and the path to its ending. And it's not meant to be a belief or a view any more than if you go to a swim instructor who's going to teach you how to swim. Learning to swim is not an opinion, right? When I heard his words, I rejoiced. So one more from these nuns. This is from a nun named Uttama. The Buddha taught seven factors of awakening. They are ways to find peace, and I have developed them all. So the seven factors of awakening, they are ways to find peace, and I have developed them all. I have found what is vast and empty, the unborn. It is what I've longed for. I am a true daughter of the Buddha, always finding joy in peace. I have always find joy in peace. Isn't that great? So she developed the seven factors of awakening. And what you see in this Buddhist tradition is the teachings of the Buddha, that there are two primary forces. There's a kind of dichotomy set up that represent different directions that our human mind can go. The human mind or heart can go in the direction of suffering, or it can go in the direction of freedom from suffering. And that distinction is very important in this early tradition, partly because it's a very pragmatic tradition that tries not to kind of bring in a lot of views and opinions about what is and isn't the case, but rather points to something that's pragmatically doable. And so that distinction, what is it that brings suffering? What is it that brings blindness? What is it that brings contraction, closed-downness? What brings difficulty? And then what is it, on the other hand, which brings awakening or freedom or light or clear seeing or relaxed expansiveness? What is it? What are these? And it turns out that there are different forces in the mind, that one force that leads in one direction and another force leads in another. And this early tradition puts a lot of emphasis on the five hindrances as being the forces that keep us in bondage, keep us in the dark, keep us blind. And a lot of practice has to do about freeing us from the five hindrances. These are the five hindrances I'm going to be talking about on Monday evenings in October. So things like being obsessed with desire, sensuality, being obsessed with aversion, being obsessed with sloth and torpor. How could you be obsessed with that? Being obsessed with restlessness and anxiety, and then being obsessed with doubt. And then on the other side of that is the seven factors of awakening. And so these seven factors of awakening are those forces which are liberating, bring clarity and light to the mind. So these are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, concentration, tranquility, and equanimity. So seven factors of awakening. And it isn't so much that these aren't, again, not beliefs, but these are qualities of the mind that are operating under different circumstances. And so in some circumstances, if we're suffering, chances are you're caught in some of these hindrances. As a person becomes freer, as the mind becomes more open, liberated, clear, seeing clearly what's here, these seven factors of awakening tend to get evoked, cultivated, strengthened, developed. They kind of follow in the wake. They're there. And They're really beautiful qualities. If you have some sense that Buddhism is a tradition, a renunciation tradition that's about deprivation, you don't know anything about the seven factors of awakening. They're the most precious and wealthiest things you can riches you could possibly have. These beautiful, beautiful qualities of heart that can offer tremendous support in our lives. So the first one is mindfulness, and the second one is investigation. So to be present. So there was this special monastery. There was an old monk who had become a hermit, and he lived far from the monastery. It was a 2.5 day trek on difficult mountain trails to visit the hermit. But people liked to visit him because he was reputed that if you went there with asking for advice, spiritual advice, practice advice, he always had just the right answer for you. And just amazing capacity to give you the tailor-made advice just for you. And so people would go there, take that long, difficult trek, 2.5 days. And when they got there, he would listen to them. And before he gave his advice or his instruction, he would always make them promise that they would not tell anyone the advice he gave to them. Secret. And then he would give them his teaching, his instruction. And he would say, "What is it you are unwilling to pay attention to?" And some of the visitors were perplexed by this initially. Some were angered. I came all this way for that. But then they had 2.5 days to walk back out of the mountains. And by the time they came out of the mountain, everyone would say, "Wow, I don't know how he did it, but he knew just the right teaching for me." So what is it you're unwilling to pay attention to bring mindfulness to? So mindfulness is to be present. Mindfulness is to not only be present, but then practice is more than just being present, but also to look carefully, deeply. What is this? What's going on here in this present moment? Not necessarily to analyze it, just think about it more, but to really to look deeply, to feel deeply, to sense deeply. What happens when we have full contact, deeper contact with this experience here? And it's remarkable how quick and easy the mind recoils or avoids full contact, full being present here for this experience. Find out what is here, what's going on, and how easy it is to be unwilling to look at parts of our lives. At a recent retreat, someone said to me, a little bit in shock at the realization, "I realize my life has been a lie." That's quite a thing. Whole areas of life, that kind of whole ways in which we're motivated and run our lives sometimes are unattended to, not noticed. So to stop, pay attention, to see what's here. So then, the next factor of awakening is effort or energy. And I love seeing little children when they're in a good mood and well rested and well fed and all the conditions are right. And this, you know, wonderful kind of spark of energy and effort and engagement, and you know, just they're you know, just there, their spines are up straight and they're just completely present and engaged. It's a capacity we all have to have energy and effort to be. And some degree of effort and energy is required to practice. There's effortless effort, which can come. There's effortful effort, but some kind of effort. And I make that point, maybe I've said this little cliche too often, but this little point by saying that mindfulness practice absolutely does not work. Unless. Absolutely does not work if you don't do it. So there has to be the effort. There has to be some engagement in it. Some of making contact, going into what's going on. Mushin was one of the more radiant monks in the monastery. The peace and joy that seemed to beam out of him inspired everyone who met him. He never seemed to want anything. But he did have a knack of being in the right place at the right time when others needed help. No one had ever seen him bothered by anything. However, this didn't seem to diminish his thoroughness in doing his job as janitor of the monastery. Since he always seemed to be at ease with his life as a monk, one day I asked him if monastic life had ever been difficult. This is what he said. My life before coming to the monastery was very difficult. In fact, I had considered taking my own life because the suffering was so great. For me, the monastery was the end of the road. I saw it as my last chance. When I first arrived at the monastery, I had a long interview with the abbot. He asked me lots of questions, and I told him things about my life that I never told anyone before. At the end of the interview, he welcomed me to the monastery. As I took my leave, I asked him what sort of spiritual practice I should undertake. Excuse me. He faced me with such a look of compassion and confidence that my first thought was that he was preparing to tell me something very important. But I was confused when all he said was, "Always walk completely through the doors." For the rest of the day, I wondered if I had heard the abbot accurately. How could walking through doors be pertinent advice to someone in my despair? Perhaps the abbot was becoming senile in his old age. But then, to my surprise, the next day the monastery doors started talking to me. Every time I went through a door, there was a faint whisper. At first, I thought I was imagining it and didn't give it much attention. But the whispering kept occurring, so I strained to hear what was being said. Thank you. It seemed that each door said the same thing. By the afternoon, I was able to make out the whisper, and what each door said was, "It is all empty." I asked the other monks if they heard the voices, but none did. Then I asked them if they knew what "it is all empty" meant. They just smiled and shrugged their shoulders as if they didn't have a clue. Pretty quickly, I decided that the voices were reminding me of the life I had left behind in joining the monastery. All the possessions I'd had, the many pursuits I had run after, the recognition I had sought, the womanizing I had done, all that was indeed empty. The doorway voices were reassuring me that I had made the right decision in coming to the monastery. They were reminding me that there was nothing anymore outside the monastery for me to go after. So at first, the voices made me happy. Reminded that the world, my worldly affairs, were shallow, I threw myself enthusiastically into the monastic life. I entered through all the doors. I met everything that came my way. What a delight to have found a meaningful life. But the voices continued to say that all was empty. And after a while, I began to have doubt about my monastic life as well. Was this life also hollow and meaningless? To add to my concerns, the voices started to speak louder. Soon I felt as much despair about the monastic life as I had in my previous life. Trying to grasp onto something that would give me meaning, I decided that I needed to devote more time to meditation and thereby develop my inner life. Certainly the pursuit of some real spiritual attainment was meaningful. The meditation practice seemed to lighten my despair. And when my meditation was deep, I was filled with confidence. I began to feel quite happy, even happy-go-lucky. I had found the key to happiness and was convinced that I was surpassing all the other monks in holiness. But every time I left the meditation hall, the doors again said, "It is all empty." After a while, this grated me, and I became increasingly angry. I was angry because the voices seemed to imply that my newfound identity as a deep spiritual person was empty. When my anger was too much for me to bear, I finally had to admit that I had been caught in pride, and that my vanity was indeed empty. After the anger passed, I still practiced my meditation practice. After all, nothing else seemed to make sense. But then the voices started commenting on the meditation itself. I heard, "All is empty," as saying that meditation itself was meaningless. With this, my despair returned more strongly than ever. I tried hiding in my room so I wouldn't have to go through any more doors. I took to climbing through windows whenever possible. When I had to pass through a door, I ran, trying to distance myself from the voices. But by now, the voices had gotten quite loud. As I ran down the halls, the phrase, "It is all empty," echoed after me. Okay, to be continued. So, effort, energy, engagement, meeting what's there. Not always easy. Sometimes meeting what's there is challenging, and there can be a lot of motivation not to be present. And a very important part of practice is to have the effort, the energy, the engagement, to engage and stay present, stay engaging with what's going on. And then engagement gives rise to joy. A very important part of the path, the Buddhist path, is developing a sense of well-being. A well-being that comes from many different sources. There's the well-being that comes from contentment. So there's a whole practice of contentment, discovering how to be content. There is a certain kind of a contentment. There's the joy that comes from engagement, from doing what we're doing. Meditation practice hopefully comes with a strong sense of joy, well-being. That's not so. It's, in some ways, it's comparable to the joy or the well-being that come from being really absorbed in a good book. There's a kind of a, when we're absorbed in just doing one thing, the way we're fragmented and divided and self-consciously preoccupied tends to fall away. And that kind of full engagement in one thing tends to bring a sense of well-being, of delight, of joy. So at some point, through a variety of sources, well-being, happiness, joy, from being on the path, from doing the practice, begins to happen. It kind of follows in the wake. You don't have to even try to develop it. But sooner or later, joy, delight becomes part of it. There's a story of a wealthy man in the time of the Buddha, businessman, very wealthy in his time, who became a monk, left it all behind and became a monk. And the other monks talked about him behind his back and said, "Ah, he's used to luxury and having servants and everything, you know, so easy for him. He's not going to manage as a renunciant. All they have is one robe, a bowl, they sleep outdoors, you know. Surely he's going to leave and go back to his old life soon." And then one day in the monastery, they heard him. He was off meditating in a grove of trees, and they heard him yell out, "Happy, happy, happy." And they looked at each other, "Yep, he's happy because he's decided to go back to his lay life." And so they went and asked him, why did you yell out happy? And he said, "Oh, when I was wealthy, I had locks on all my doors, I had guards posted everywhere, and it was dangerous for me to go about. I was always concerned and worried and upset about it, you know. And now, I don't have anything to lose. Nothing for anybody to steal from me. I don't have to keep my doors locked. And I'm free. I'm relaxed. I'm so much happier this way." So happy. How do you get happy? How do you get content? So the next factor of awakening is calmness or tranquility. And be relaxed? How do we discover how to be relaxed? Can we be relaxed? It's a great protection in Buddhist practice if you remember to keep being relaxed close at hand for the practice. I've known plenty of people, including myself, who've gotten tense in trying to practice. I'm trying to get something, I have to get concentrated. Okay, joy, I'm supposed to be joyful. And just to be at ease with how things are. Two young men entered the monastery on the same day. One was an overconfident aristocrat who entered the monastery with a sense of entitlement. The other was a son of local farmers who had spent his life helping on the small, poor family farm. During their entrance interview, the abbot asked them why they were becoming monks. The aristocrat said they had come to climb to the highest achievement of human life, to experience the bliss, the glory, and the brilliant light of liberation. The peasant said, "I am poor and unschooled, and I have no hope of enlightenment. However, I hope to see the Dharma in the everyday things and activities of my life. May I see the truth in the food I eat, in the work I do, and the people I encounter." Within 6 months, the peasant was graced with liberation. The aristocrat is still striving on courageously. So, to be at ease. What does it mean to be at ease? To find our ease with how things are. The next factor of awakening is concentration. So these two factors together, tranquility and concentration, go close at hand. Often quite closely connected, because as we get more concentrated, there's deeper calm that can come. As we're calm, there's easier to get concentrated. The venerable monk was always appeared peaceful. This was not so unusual among the monks of the monastery. However, this venerable one was unique, and that he remained peaceful and calm even after entering the busy and noisy bustle of the town market. He was the monastery shopper who on most days spent hours bargaining for the best prices for the produce he bought for the monks. When asked how he managed to remain peaceful in the busy marketplace, he said, "I entered the monastery looking for peace and quiet. I had spent years in the harried world of commerce and people. I longed for the silence the monastery was rumored to have. I was delighted with my first weeks in the monastery. However, as I settled into the silence of the place, I was shocked to learn that the real noise was within me. It was the busyness of my own mind that oppressed me, not the activities of the world. Now it doesn't matter where I go, I carry the great silence within me." So what does it mean to find, to be concentrated, composed, to be at peace, to be at ease with how things are? There was a monarch of a great country who didn't feel much peace. So the monarch asked the ministers, "I would like to have a contest. Whoever can paint, do a painting that best depicts peace, will get a great prize." They sent the dues out to the country, and many people submitted their paintings. The ministers went through them all, and the monarch reviewed them all, one at a time. And they'd gone through almost all of them. And there were obvious things. There were beautiful pictures of alpine lakes, so peaceful and calm and still, or beautiful calm ocean sunrises, just very peaceful and tranquil look. There was beautiful idyllic paintings of the deer and the meadow, Bambi. And there was even paintings of Sunday morning meditation at IMC. And the monarch rejected them all. And the minister said, "What do we do? Seems to be rejecting them all." And they said finally, well, there was one more painting that we thought we didn't need to bother to look at. Because it's such an agitated, almost a violent painting. It's not peaceful at all. So the monarch said, oh, let's look at it. We've looked at everything else and nothing seemed to work for me. And so they brought out the big painting, and it was really, in some ways, a violent, agitated painting. It was a painting of a very powerful waterfall. And it was, if you've ever been to a big waterfall, you're cascading powerful water and splashing up and making all this foam and steam and fog, and, it just looked, deadly to get close to it. Just, And they said, oh, what's going on here? This is not peaceful. So the monarch got interested and got really close to the big painting. He said, ah, yes, this one wins the prize. They said, what do you see? He said, come look closely right here. If you got close to the painting, you saw in a little bit of it, a place where the water parted a little bit, parted apart, and there was a little kind of opening. And you look through that little opening in the water, you saw in there a little ledge. The little ledge was a little hollow. The little hollow, someone had, a bird had made a little nest. And there was a little bird peacefully sitting there, tending its eggs. So that's real peace. To find the peace in the midst of our economic crisis. The midst of our difficult life, not to retreat from our life necessarily, but how do we find that within? How do we find the peace not dependent on the conditions around us? And so then the last factor of awakening is equanimity. This fantastic capacity that is usually underappreciated. Equanimity can seem to kind of like boring or dull, or being non-reactive is like pretty, inhuman. But it turns out that the quality of equanimity, this powerful factor of awakening, is kind of like the most sublime and most satisfying emotion a person can have. It's very alive, it's very vibrant or very luminous. The mind that is equanimous but has built in equanimity doesn't react. Not for things, not against things. It maintains its luminosity, maintains its peace. It's not ruffled. Things come through. All kinds of things can happen, but the mind doesn't contract, doesn't lash out. The mind keeps its equanimity, its peace, this kind of wonderful state. It's a wonderful place to be. There's a famous story of I think it's Ryokan, I don't remember who it is, but a Zen monk in Japan. And in his village, there was a teenage girl, unmarried teenage girl who got pregnant. And when the baby was born, the parents said, you have to tell us who the father is. And so she lied and she said, oh, it's the village priest. So the parents angrily brought the baby to the village priest and said, this is yours. You have to take responsibility for it. And he said, oh, that's so. And he started caring for the baby very lovingly and responsibly, best he could. And after some months, the teenage girl had a change of heart and, maybe felt that she missed her child. And so she went to her parents and said, I'll tell you who the real father is. It's, that neighbor boy. Whatever. So then the parents were kind of aghast at what they'd done, so they went back to the village monk and said, oh, we're so sorry. We made a terrible mistake. We would like to have the baby back now. And so the monk said, oh, is that so? He gave the baby back. So things come, things go. His reputation went up and down. But it's kind of at least a kind of a teaching or a story about equanimity. So then back to the original story, or the story about going through the doors. Remember that one? But by now the voices had gotten quite loud. As I ran down the halls, the phrase, "It is all empty," echoed after me. After a while, every thought I had, every wish I hoped for, and every effort I made was attacked by, "It is all empty," resonating throughout the monastery. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore. I ran toward the front gate of the monastery. I was going to find a tall mountain cliff and throw myself off. It did not make sense to keep living if living was going to be so bad. But as I came to the front gate, the gate doors loomed large in front of me. I became too frightened to go through it. It was as if I could not survive one more voice telling me that it is all empty. After I stood frozen for a long time, I remembered the practice the abbot had given me on my first day in the monastery. Always walk completely through the doors. The instruction had seemed so empty and meaningless when I first heard it. Now it seemed too monumental. I could not manage to get myself to pass through the front gate. Inside my head, a voice kept repeating, "It's all empty, it's all empty." My mind couldn't find anything to rest on, because when it did, I was reminded that this too was empty. My mind became increasingly contracted in on itself. It kept pulling away from everything I had ever been attached to. The abbot's instruction came back to me, "Always walk completely through the gates, through the doors." That there was nothing for me to do. I took the step through the gates. Again, my contracted mind pulled away from almost everything but itself, heard, "It is all empty." And with that, I let go of my mind. Then I turned around and re-entered the monastery. Since that day, the voices stopped, and I never again worried about the meaning of anything. Neither despair nor hope are relevant for me. It is emptiness itself which lives through me. So when equanimity is well established, and when the seven factors of awakening are well developed, it's a wonderful stage, it's a wonderful platform from which the mind can let go of itself. And so, at the end, whether it's through the challenges this monk has, or through entering peace like an arrow of these early nuns, the Buddhist tradition points to a possibility for all of us. It's a possibility of an astounding level of peace, well-being, and freedom, which will serve you as a repository of inner wealth much better than any American bank. May you open the treasure door to your own hearts. Thank you.